you. May it please the court, I'm Frank Friedman, representing Dr. Michael Gross in Prince William Plastic Surgery. Susan L. Mitchell and Walton Milam are with me at counsel's table, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Two,
yes, sir. This medical malpractice appeal involves an expert witness issue, and the central question is if an expert has a reprimand or other medical discipline on his record that's wholly unrelated to the procedure at issue and unrelated to the topic of the expert testimony, is evidence of the discipline admissible or inadmissible under Stottlemyre versus Graham and Rule 2608B? And if the fact of the reprimand is generally admissible, can the lengthy allegations of the medical board charges be read to the jury in detail to tarnish the expert's character?
What about to tarnish the expert's credibility, since the expert is offering an opinion that a layperson could not offer and whose credibility is the most important issue in the case for the expert?
Well, the issue, you know, basically comes down there to 2608B, which essentially says that you can't use past bad acts to attack credibility. So the question really is,
otherwise when the law allowed in expert testimony, you're constantly attacking the credibility of the expert on matters that have any relationship at all to the credibility of his or her knowledge of the standard of care.
Well, and that sort of also comes back to really the critical issue, which is, what is the standard of care? Is it anything you do as a doctor ever, or is it the standard of care under 801.581.20, which is the standard of care for a blepharoplasty in this case? And does this have anything to do with a blepharoplasty? And if it doesn't, then our position is it shouldn't come in because it's going to be prejudicial beyond belief, and it's going to cause a trial within a trial that's collateral, that has nothing to do with the standard of care, which is what the doctor is there to talk about. Here, the expert doctor's reprimand was...
Why do you say it's a trial within a trial? I mean, here, granted, there's a few pages of testimony, but it's not... it doesn't go on and on and sort of take over the life of the trial.
Well, it took over the expert's testimony. I mean, there was more discussion about his deployment problems than there was about whether or not Dr. Gross met the standard of care for a blepharoplasty.
I mean, when I hear trial within a trial, I hear, well, it's, you know, we're going to go at great length on something which unnecessarily complicates a trial, but impeachment. I mean, it can be lengthy or short.
Well, but it also can be permissible or impermissible.
Oh, right, and that goes to a different point. I was just concerned about your sort of mechanics of trial point, that this is going to alter the dynamic.
Okay, well, just for a little background, here the expert doctor's reprimand was settled by a consent decree, a small fine, JA 4243.
So it was uncontested that he violated the ethical requirement or the standard requirement. So why does that help you? Why doesn't it hurt you?
It wasn't uncontested. He neither admitted or denied the charges at 4243.
Well, that usually means it's uncontested. If you don't deny it, it means you're not contesting it.
Well, the question, again, it's a little circular, but it comes back to, did what the consent decree dealt with have anything to do with the standard of care in this case? And, you know, none of the alleged wrongdoing involved a blepharoplasty, a ptosis, or any other medical issue related to this case.
Wouldn't it have been different if the discipline had something to do with an actual procedure that was done, not necessarily this one, but another procedure?
These were charges like Botox in the refrigerator. If this had been a Botox case, we think it would be different because it would come in under the knowledge prong of 801.581.20. But this...
I'm saying, what if it wasn't? What if it was like him completely botching a tummy tuck operation because he was not diligent in doing something.
Well, our position is something completely different like that and something completely different like a blepharoplasty that isn't even mentioned at all in this. It's not admissible. And to the extent it is, and maybe I should jump to options.
Aren't there really several layers of questions? One is it relevant to the procedure, number
correct.
One? And if the answer is yes, it is, then the question is it more prejudicial than it is helpful and probative to the issues in the case? So there's at least two questions.
100% correct. And here there was no evidence other than the fact that, you know, you're a doctor, so you follow rules. It had nothing to do with this this procedure. You know, by the same token, you follow the law, so are your speeding tickets admissible? They're not.
Well, it would be, I mean, there's several levels. If it was a discipline that had something to do with dishonesty or trustworthiness, things of that nature, that could be impeachment purposes.
Although I will say, and I agree with you, I think that's one of the examples where it would. If it's falsifying records, it probably comes in under a different rule. I might add, in Stottlemyre, one of the claims was falsifying records. So let me get to Stottlemyre. Under Stottlemyre versus Graham, collateral evidence is inadmissible, and this, we think, was collateral. It had nothing to do with the standard of care for this procedure at all.
But that's a med-mal physician who's a defendant, a party to the case. We're talking about an expert who's paid to give an opinion.
You're exactly right, and I'm right there. Under Stottlemyre, Rule 2608B, evidence of prior bad acts doesn't come in. But in Stottlemyre, you have the witness is the defendant himself. So we recognize that that's a difference. Although the Stottlemyre language broadly applies to all witnesses, and that's consistent with Rule 2608B, it doesn't say you're allowed to use bad acts to you know, taint someone.
Well,
unless
it's clear that Stottlemyre wasn't ruling on the question of the credibility of paid experts offering opinions.
Well, and I agree with that, although we quoted in our brief language that the language is consistent, and so is Rule 2608B. But the reasons given by plaintiff for admission of this discipline was to challenge credibility, J527-116. That's the reason. And again, under Virginia law, that's exactly what 2608B prohibits. And that's it. They don't mention 2608B in all their analysis for other statutes. Now, even if this is generally relevant and there are states that say a reprimand is entitled to some muted reference without you did this, 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 and this. No, I didn't. The whole trial is about his deployment, not about Dr. Gross's standard of care. Some jurisdictions allow that. We tried to evenly give you cases that do that. Courts in Virginia did that before Stottlemyre. We give you the Ney case from a circuit court.
And the rule about bad acts is so that you don't use someone's bad character or bad unrelated acts to impose liability on them. That's just plain unfair.
That's not credibility, sir. Credibility is what 2608B says, and that's is he believable? And you don't take that's Gamache versus Allen. It's established. You don't do it. And it's really important here because you know. You can admit, have you ever had some jurisdictions, the Ney case, have you ever had a run-in with discipline? Yes, but that's all.
So
it's kind of like Rule 2609B.
You come to trial and the expert is proffered to the jury. This paid hired expert is credible. You should believe him. And he has an opinion on this particular doctor's wrongdoing. And the guy has 10 medical malpractice judgments against him, but it has nothing to do with the procedure in question. You don't think that would be something a jury would want to know and should know? Because he's not credible, and the question is not can it be done, it's managing it, using good judgment.
Well, admitting the details of irrelevant allegation after irrelevant allegation in a consent decree, basically, no jurisdictions allow that. There's not a case cited in their brief. that allows that. It's usually one of two things. And so maybe I should skip to where Chief Justice Lemons is leading me. Regardless, in this case, the way it played out, plaintiff's cross-examination plainly ran afoul of Rule 2403. At a minimum, the prejudice greatly outweighed any probative value and tainted the trial, which was a battle of experts. This attack had nothing to do with the standard of care in this case. Now, plaintiff suggests that this case should be weighed under a simple abuse of discretion standard, and that in every case, whatever the judge decides, the expert discipline should get in or not, and then you don't have a consistent outcome. So whatever the court decides to do, apply a strict 2608B, which is what Stottlemyre says, and which a lot of states do. Whether you apply something kin to what Ney did, kin to a 2609B crime analysis that lets it in, disclosure without turning it into a trial within a trial.
Has any Virginia case used 608 to eliminate evidence on the credibility of a hired professional expert? Has that ever happened in Virginia? And is that, if the answer is no, doesn't that imply pretty strongly that 608 is dealing with the Stottlemyre situation?
I don't think it does, because I think most courts in this state apply Stottlemyre as if, unless it's dead on, and if it doesn't, then the parties basically agree that we'll do what 609B does, and we'll say, yeah, he's had this run-in. Nay. I guess the answer is nay. What Ney did is a good outcome. It says, look, you can ask, have you ever had a problem? Then you can ask, does it have anything to do with this case? Nothing more. That's the way this gets handled most of the time.
What court issued it?
It was the Circuit Court of Alexandria.
Okay, well, the Circuit Court issued a case here. Why would one case be better than the other in terms of precedent?
Because its analysis is better. Because this case, there's no cases. Again, we challenged them to cite us a case. This is a 2403. And again, if the court wants to say that that's allowed, there were three options I was going to give. You can apply Stottlemyre. You can apply what Ney did. You can apply 2403, or you can say, let it all in. Then people will know what to do. But this is irrelevant testimony that has nothing to do with the standard of care. And what you're really doing is making it a standard of care for life. Imagine if a lawyer came up and tried to say what the law is. How many speeding tickets do you have? Well, you have no respect for the law. How can we accept what you're telling us? That's the argument that is being made here. I will reserve the rest of my time, but I will get to the consent issue when I come back, because that is also a cause for reversing this case.
152. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Peruschek. With me is Gary Mims, and we represent Ms. Stewart, the appellee, in this case. As the court knows, there are two substantive issues, the mistrial, the informed consent as it's been called, and also this question over Dr. Pittman. Both of these issues involve the abuse of discretion standard. This court has described that standard as offering the trial court a range of choices, and as long as the trial court stays within that range, you affirm on appeal. To put it another way, you reverse only if you find that no reasonable jurist would have done what the trial court did here. When you review the facts of this case, when you see what the judge did when he was faced with both this issue of consent and also the question of whether or not Dr. Pittman should be cross-examined on these issues, it's clear that the judge did not make a snap decision. The judge was deliberate. The judge was thoughtful. He clearly understood that there were questions of probative value being weighed against danger of unfair prejudice, and he made a decision. I would submit to this court that not only did the trial court act as though many reasonable jurists would, but also he weighed his discretion appropriately and therefore should be affirmed. I noticed that counsel spent most of their time on the Dr. Pittman issue, so I'll turn to that first. I think it's telling in this particular case that there were two different judges of this trial court that were faced with the question of whether or not we should be able to cross-examine Dr. Pittman about these allegations. There was a motion in limine, and then the issue essentially was fully re-argued at trial. Both of these judges independently came to the same conclusion. They both independently concluded that there was probative value to the evidence, and then they both weighed that probative value against the danger of unfair prejudice.
Okay, help me with understand why when you hold someone out as, well, he's this very knowledgeable person, you should accept his testimony as controlling, you want to go after his credibility, and so if that person has been disciplined, why not make that part of the credibility analysis? But then they get into, well, you had Botox in your fridge and you didn't clean up your operating room, and then you didn't refer out patients to appropriate other providers. And the issue is, was there a breach of standard of care on the IR operation? They seem to delve into that level of detail. Seems like it could sidetrack the jury. Help me with that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that it wasn't in this case just one or two allegations, and I think that probably weighed in the trial court's decision. It was many. I noticed the Botox is frequently referenced. I think that's an easy one for the other side to point to. I think the most egregious example is this doctor signed prescription pads, left blank prescriptions for unlicensed staff, to hand out to people. And so if it was one, maybe we'd be having a different conversation, but there were many, over 10 allegations over how this doctor practices medicine, and that's the key. They all related to specifically to how he practiced medicine. And your concern is, if we start talking about those things, are we going to get sidetracked? And really the answer to that is, well, if that's the case, then why are they allowed on direct examination to go much broader than the specific procedure that was at issue in this case? I mean, Judge Ascarati in the motion in limine actually made a very astute observation. Aren't you going to go into everything wonderful that this doctor has ever done on direct examination? And that's exactly what happened. The questions on direct were not limited to blepharoplasty. It wasn't that narrow. It went far beyond that. In fact, perhaps the most egregious example of going far beyond it was the military service. I mean, I know he wasn't performing cosmetic blepharoplasties while he was deployed. So why was it introduced? It was introduced because they were trying to prop up this expert, to say he's going to give you opinions on the standard of care, but because of these other things, you should believe him more than the plaintiff's expert.
He's really awesome, so believe him. Well, it turns out he has some blemishes, so don't believe him.
Well, did you object to how awesome he was being admitted into evidence?
No, Your Honor, because I think it is relevant.
If the standard of care for a male expert is knowledge of the is limited to the procedure at issue, why is any of it relevant that he was deployed, that he left Botox and unsigned prescription pads, if the issue on which he is testifying is the procedure at issue? And our cases have been really careful to point out when someone is or is not an expert that it is with regard to the procedure at issue. So if he has performed every one of the exams at issue perfectly, what does it matter that he went to Afghanistan, and what does it matter that he left, how is it relevant that he left prescription pads?
Perhaps the jury would conclude that, Your Honor. Perhaps they would say, we're not going to give it much weight. But it's relevant because of what he said when he testified. He said, I base my testimony on my education, training, and experience. He did not say, I base it solely on my knowledge of blepharoplasties. He did not say, I base it solely on the number of blepharoplasties that I've done in the past. And I think it's appropriate for him to say that because I understand the standard of care is, do you know how this medical procedure should be done? But to think that we can have a doctor testify about that without knowing the underpinnings, their general medical knowledge, I just don't think there's a way for juries to be able to draw distinctions between the experts. On every medical malpractice case, every personal injury case, of course the questions are asked of a doctor when qualifying them. Where did you go to medical school? Where did you do your internship? Have you published anything? The CV goes into evidence. Obviously the CV frequently has publications and speaking engagements that are far outside the specific procedure. Why? Because the jury has to get an understanding of this doctor's background if they're going to have some sort of basis to assess what their opinions are. And I'd suggest to the court that's true for both sides. It's important for plaintiffs and defendants, but I'd suggest especially for plaintiffs it's important because we carry the burden of proof. And so if they're permitted on direct examination, to quote Judge Ascarati, to bring out everything great you've ever done, but on cross we rule that it's collateral to talk about perhaps bad things that you've done, what's going to happen in every case is the defense lawyers will stand up and they'll say, you've heard from a believable expert from the plaintiff and you have no reason to disbelieve that they know the standard of care. The same is true of us.
You've answered my question. You may want to.
Thank you.
I mean, if you're still addressing him.
Are you suggesting, I'm just trying to find out, this is not a challenge, I'm just trying to find out what you're saying, that he testified that his testimony is based on his experience, training, his education, training, and experience. Having said that, if part of his experience is sloppy procedures, lack of meticulous care of medicines, et cetera, as came out in here, that's what makes it fair game? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm suggesting we be allowed to do it absent that. I think that we have to have a basis to differentiate the experts. And when an expert says, I know the standard of care, which obviously is a requirement under the medical malpractice statute, in proffering, again, as Justice Kelsey pointed out, this is a paid expert hired for their opinion. We have to have an ability to be able to say to the jury, this gentleman told you he knows the standard of care, but look at how he practices medicine. Just because he hasn't had a bad blepharoplasty, maybe he's had 10 medical malpractice cases. Would you go to this doctor? And if you wouldn't go to him, is this someone you want to believe who comes in and says, believe me, I know what I'm talking about when I talk about blepharoplasties?
Well, it seems to me from what I heard you say that you would think that you're allowed to do that. And because you say that, you agree that the other side would have the opportunity to say, he works 15 to 20 hours a week in a free clinic. Would you say that's fair?
I would, and I'd say that happens on direct.
That's the problem. All of a sudden, you're out on these issues that are collateral to the issue of the standard of care. At some point in time, it is a trial within a trial on collateral matters.
Your Honor, you're right. At some point it is. But that's why we have the rule, the relevance rules, as a way for the trial court to face these issues when they come up. There's no question that my argument in this case is affected by the nature and number of the allegations. And so if he was suspended 30 years ago, by way of example, and was reinstated, perhaps a different trial court would come to a different conclusion. But the bottom line, when this court is faced with this issue, as you said in the Riverside Hospital case, whether something is probative or not is something that you leave a great deal of discretion to the trial court. Two judges here said, I think it is probative. And then, of course, stepping to the second issue of does the danger of unfair prejudice substantially outweigh, both judges ruled the same way. And so there is, you're right, at some point you may get into a trial within a trial. But the question for this court is, on this record, did we get into a trial within a trial? I'd submit we did not.
Well, see, but the problem with that, and I you're doing a great job arguing your case. The problem with that is that you have one case. We have thousands of cases that we worry about when we hand down a ruling like this. And that's what concerns me. I'm trying to figure out how you actually write the rule of law that resolves this question. It seems to me, and you can respond any way you'd like to this, but it seems to me that you have introduced his custom and practice for being sloppy and not careful and not meticulous by putting in this discipline issue. Am I right? Is that why it's relevant to you?
How he practices medicine
is
relevant.
That's why I heard that, how he practices medicine. So that's custom and practice, it seems to me. And your evidence is that here's a disciplinary action that will tell you what his custom and practice is. Now, the other side could say, yeah, but that was 25 years ago, and he's been free of any discipline, et cetera. Maybe that's a probative relevance kind of analysis. But my concern is that why is it in there in the first place when the question is standard of care?
It's in there, Your Honor, because the jury is instructed that it has to listen to the expert witnesses when determining the standard. And then it's instructed that you should consider the basis of the expert's opinion when deciding who to believe. Let's step back and remember, medical malpractice cases are somewhat unique in that one of the elements that I have to prove requires an expert. The standard of care actually requires an expert. That's somewhat unique. And so if the jury's instructed you need to listen to the experts, the jury's instructed essentially you have to choose who to believe, and I'm not permitted to call into question how this doctor practices medicine. I don't know how the jury is going to be able to decide who to believe, and my concern is what we're going to end up with in every case is a tie, which a tie goes to them. The court is looking for what ruling it should give in this case, and the ruling should be under the facts of this case, the court did not abuse its discretion. I don't think you need to go any further than that. I think that
I'm actually looking for something more fundamental than that. I'm looking for the rule of law that governs that determination.
I think the rule of law is that it is legally relevant to the basis of his opinions. In this case, unquestionably, when he said he based his opinions on his education, training, and experience.
But see, I have the right to talk about his credibility. I have the right to talk about his custom and practice for performing this sort of surgery. It seems to me you're on solid ground. But the sort of custom and practice generally, how do we resolve these questions in the next case if that's just an open door that everybody can walk through?
I guess I just respectfully disagree that I think it would be an open door. I don't think it would be. I think this is certainly a factual analysis, and under these facts in this case, I think what the trial court did was appropriate. If I may say to the court, I'm concerned about a ruling saying this is inadmissible, or if this court were to rule that this is collateral, what certainly is going to happen is we will turn around and when experts are being qualified on direct, say, well, wait a minute, the Supreme Court has said that any matter outside of the blepharoplasty in this particular case is collateral. Well, if it's collateral on cross, how is it not collateral on direct examination?
I understand that's your risk. That is your risk if you open this door. If this discipline was, I'll just make it more closely related to the actual surgery, was that this doctor doesn't wash, he doesn't scrub before he does surgery. Now, I've heard you would say that's fair game.
It may be. And that's what I'm trying to say is I think it depends on the facts of the case. I think in that alone, if a trial court were to exclude evidence of that fact alone, could I stand here and say, I see my time's up if
You're
I may finish. Could I stand up here and say the trial court abused its discretion and made a determination that this one allegation was so overwhelmingly prejudicial compared to what it would offer in the case? Could I stand here and say that was an abuse of discretion? No. Probably not.
Well, see, now that's where I'm trying to get to. Is this a question of probative versus prejudicial? Is that how you would resolve this?
Yes.
And if that's a discretionary call as an abuse of discretion, and we have to trust the trial judges to do it.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I understand your position now. Go ahead.
So Dr. Pittman's CV is in the record.
Yes, sir.
Submitted as an exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
If in the process of qualifying him, your opposing counsel had said, now, Dr. Pittman, I understand that you are a retired Army colonel and that you assisted with Haitian nationals after an earthquake and that you volunteered to help burn victims, knowing that there are members of the jury who are retired military, or knowing that you've got people on the jury who come from churches that might do missions to Haiti, would you have objected to that? If they had gone through the CV and had been looking at, because he's got a very impressive CV.
He does. No.
You would not have objected?
I think if I'm saying to the court that I should be able to call into question beyond the specific procedure, I think then on direct it has to be fair game for them to put in medical experience or training or things like that outside of the specific procedure. So for him to say, for them to say that, I don't think I would have an objection. And I'll tell the court, too, I think as a practical matter, this happens all the time. I mean, there's always things in the CV beyond the specific procedure. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of one. That happens in every case. And I've never heard of a trial judge striking the CV or not letting it in. Or
not a matter of striking it. It's a matter of actually at trial in front of the jury pointing out things that are not relevant. And I just,
I think I'd have a hard time objecting because, again, at the end of the day, we need to give the jury an ability to weigh the testimony of the experts.
Did the CV go into evidence, or was it just in the record?
It was put into evidence, Your Honor. It was admitted.
So all the right. relevance is you should believe this guy, or you shouldn't believe this guy.
Yes, Your Honor. On both sides, it's the same. Should his opinions on the standard of care be believed?
Could you address Gamache versus Allen, the case that was cited by your opponents?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't recall. There was a number of cases.
That case says that you can't include the commission of specific acts of untruthfulness or other bad conduct, even though these have bearing on veracity.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm happy to address that. I actually think that ruling is probably now encompassed in Rule 608. This, I heard a lot of argument about 608. I was not putting this into evidence to suggest he's a liar. I mean, that's the bottom line. Rule 608 is reputation for truthfulness. The purpose of this evidence was not to say he's untruthful. What I was trying to say is, I'm sure he believes he knows the standard of care, but maybe you should question whether he does. So I just don't think I don't think that ruling or 608 apply.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal. I know you want to get into informed consent, but would you take a question just right at the outset on what we just said? Basically, I think what I hear him saying is that if it's remotely relevant, it comes in. If it also passes the prejudicial probative analysis, and that's where the war is. What do you say about that?
Well, I guess our position is we think this went way beyond the prejudice and probative.
Okay, well, that might be the case, but is that where the battle is?
I don't think so. I think what their position, and Gamache and other cases, basically what their position is 2608B doesn't apply to experts, which is interesting because really I think I heard, and I agree, 801-581-20 sets the standard of care here. And if every expert says, I base it on my experience, if that opens anything in his experience that's bad up to let's throw 2608B out the window, I mean, what about, you know, unpaid treating physicians? What about every doctor that testifies? Discovery, anything bad, any lawsuit that there's ever been, any patient critique? Discovery is going to be really interesting. They are proposing a sea change, actually.
Has 608 ever been applied to a paid, hired expert in which the first question on the table is not what he's going to say, but should I be listening to him at all? Has 608 ever been applied to a paid expert?
I don't think it's ever not been applied. I think it's so that agreed to. I think the closest
Gamache where it's been applied.
Gamache is cited. I mean, let me say real quickly, and I'm happy to answer more questions on this. On the consent issue, they argued that exploration deviated from the standard of care with no evidence. There's no evidence of that. JA 505 says it was perfectly right to do it. And they argued consent was not followed. They didn't plead it. So all we asked for was an instruction that says consent isn't in the case. It shouldn't have been a big deal. But they fought it. It wasn't in the case. They persisted in raising that issue, and we asked for the exact right instruction. It was denied. I'm happy to answer any other questions on it is a really important issue.
Justice Goodwin has a question for you.
Yeah. your opponent, in essence, says that if your rule is put into place, it's going to limit what you can ask of an expert on direct examination concerning anything that doesn't have to do with the specific procedure and issue. What do you say to that?
I don't think that's right, because I don't think that's how it's worked over the years. I will say this, and
you wouldn't be able to say, my man is a recognized expert, he's highly renowned, he's given awards across the board, and he wouldn't be able to say, except for the fact that he has disciplinary infractions that he agreed to.
Well, he might be able to say, have you ever had a disciplinary infraction, and does it relate to this case? That's what most states do, or they say you can't let it in. We're following the mainstream. We gave all the cases, they gave none. But to answer the related concern, because I think generally it comes in, and then 2608 stops bad acts. I guess somebody could object, but here, think about this case,
I'm sorry, if individual bad acts are excluded and individual good acts would be too, I mean.
Well, then they should have objected. But the point is here, imagine, they've said, oh, we didn't ask, we were really nice, we didn't ask what the sanction was from this board hearing, like that was a good thing. Well, they implied that this guy had the epaulets ripped off his uniform and he was drummed out of the Corps. In fact, he got a rather minor reprimand. Now, if we had said that, does that open the door to the whirlwind? It shouldn't. We you know, responded. But it is a trial within a trial. It totally overtook whether or not Dr. Gross met the standard of care, and it had nothing to do with whether Dr. Gross...
I guess the question, to be a little bit more pointed, given your view of this, at trial, if they tried to put into evidence that their expert had served in Afghanistan as a military officer, is that objectionable? I mean, because it doesn't have anything to do with the procedure. He certainly wasn't doing this procedure when he was in Afghanistan. So is that out of bounds now?
I think normally, you know, just being honest, I think normally it's probably wise to tie it in. You know, I'm sure he was doing plastic surgery there. I may have had something closer to do with blepharoplasty. It's nice to tie it into blepharoplasty. But here, what I heard was this under 801.581.20 has nothing to do with the standard of care for a blepharoplasty, but it has something to do with being a doctor generally, so it shouldn't come in. So everything comes in. We say it shouldn't come in. And it's tight, but what we really are asking here is, what is the standard of care? And it's 801.581.20, the procedure at issue. It's not anything out there.
All right.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you for a very well-argued case.
Thank you.
Call the next case.